Welcome back to Project Geekology for our 72nd episode. Today, we are following the Rebel Alliance as they're being absolutely tormented by the Galactic Empire. It's been 3 years since the Battle of Yavin, where Luke Skywalker, daring pilot, little kid from Tatooine, you might have heard of him, blew up the Death Star. You know, the biggest weapon that's ever been created in the entire galaxy. And yeah, they're on the run. He's still trying to learn how to become a Jedi. They're sending probes out all over the galaxy, and they finally find them on Hoth, the Rebel base. And it's just a crazy whirlwind from there. So we're going to be talking all about The Empire Strikes Back, the second Star Wars movie, or the fifth chronologically, in the saga. I'm one of your hosts, Dakota, and I'm joined as always with
Anthony.
And before we begin any of that, Anthony, what have you been up to, my friend?
You know, man, I've just been up to extra nerdy stuff. I've only really been up to...
If you say Persona, I'm going to rage quit this call right here. Well, right
I mean, come on, man. You know I'm always playing Persona, but I went to go see... In the time of our last episode, we recorded our previous few episodes pretty quickly. So within this past week, I actually went to go see that Demon Slayer movie. I really wouldn't call it a movie though. It's not a movie. It's like a prolonged episode, but it's.
Is it like feature length?
Like a long? Yeah. It's like a long episode, okay. But it's. Really the end of season 3 and then the first episode of season 4. And so I went and I got to go see that. And of course, you know, I like Demon Slayer, so I really enjoyed that. I haven't seen Dune 2 yet. I actually might see it today as
a
recording.
What are you Dune to me?
I've just been busy, actually, so that's really, what's been messing around, but I do plan on seeing it, you know, maybe today as a recording or sometime this upcoming week.
Yeah.
I've seen that it's been getting some pretty good reviews, and
yeah,
I mean, I really enjoyed the first part. Is this movie broken up into 3 parts, or is it just 2 parts?
It's kind of hard to explain. Well, it's not super hard. The first book is broken up into 2 movies. So Dune Part 1 and Dune Part 2 are both comprising the first book.
Okay.
Denis Villeneuve wants to make a 3rd part about the 2nd book. That's like his goal. Like, he would want to do a trilogy, even though the story goes on way past that point. But he wants to do the basic Paul Atreides arc of him becoming this evil emperor, basically, of the galaxy. So the first part of Dune is very much like him, Paul Atreides, coming to Arrakis and seeing his family brutally murdered, or, you know, just eradicated by the Harkonnens. Second movie is him creating an uprising. You know, I don't want to spoil too much about it, but it is it's an insane movie. I watched it on Thursday, opening night. I saw it at my local Alamo Draft House, and man, what?
Any special glasses?
No. It was just beer glasses, because yeah, I was drinking beer. Otherwise, it was pretty amazing. I was trying to see it in IMAX yesterday. I had tickets to go see it yesterday, but I ended up spending the day in the hospital. Not anything with me. It was a family member, but yeah, everything seems to be okay, so no worries currently. But yeah, I'll have to try to see it in IMAX. That's the preferred showing, by the way. Scenes filmed in IMAX, so if you can, especially with that soundtrack, with that booming soundtrack, dude, it'll shake your socks off.
Well, that's how I saw the first part, so that's what I plan on seeing the second part. So these first 2 parts cover the OG movie, where the OG movie pretty much covers from them coming to Arrakis all the way up to the uprising. So these 2 movies covers that whole period.
Yeah, I would say that in the book, The more interesting half is the first half. Just because you have the political intrigue, you're learning about the galaxy as a whole. And the second half of the book, it's easier to overlook just because it's, I think, a little bit less substantial. You know, he's hiding in the desert, he's learning how to ride sandworms and stuff like that. But they really, the director really did his all to like bring this side of the story to the front. And I think that's something that the original David Lynch 1984 movie, I think it was, didn't really capture. I think most of the film took place in the first half of the book, and then they kind of like jumped forward to the end, you know, like in quick succession, basically, after Paul and his mother were kicked out of their home on Arrakis. But yeah, the first book is pretty much everything that happens in that 1984 Dune movie.
Okay, so that's what we get. So the second part is capping that off, pretty much.
Yeah, and man, some excellent performances, like just crazy cast. Austin Butler, he was in that Elvis movie a couple years ago at this point.
Right.
He did a fantastic job as Fade Rautha. If you remember from the David Lynch movie, that was the character played by Sting.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering which was the Sting equivalent.
Yeah, he is the Sting equivalent, and great job, dude. Like, there's a scene that blew me away, and it takes place on Geaty Prime, which is the Harkonnen homeworld, and it's like in an arena or something, and you know, there's this big like fight that happens in an arena, like off planet, on the Harkonnen homeworld, and I don't know. I'm guessing this is how I interpreted it, but like the light on that planet is such that like all color is like drained from the sky, basically, and it's just like very harsh black and white, and it's such a cool aesthetic. Like when you see it, you'll obviously know what I'm talking about. But yeah, it's just so cool. I don't want to talk too much about it because we can do a whole podcast on that. But
well, I mean, we still have to. That was actually a plan like a while back
Dune 1 and Dune 2. Yeah,
correct. We did cover the OG Dune, which like that was a while back.
That was a fun podcast.
Yeah, it was. There are some instances I will say in that original movie that's a little bit hard to watch because you don't know what you're watching or what you're seeing. It's if you don't know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. I actually really like that movie, and in some ways, like there are things in that movie that are more true to the story of the book than this current movie is. Even though like the adaptions that they created for this Dune movie just make more sense in this setting, you know. It's hard to explain without like having you read the book and then watch the movie and all that, so I don't want to get too much into it. But what I will say is I watched Empire Strikes Back to like, you know, ready myself for this episode. I've seen it 100 times.
Same.
I've seen it
at this point. It's like at this point, it's not. We weren't even watching it to.
It was just
to prepare for the podcast. It
background was more stuff.
It was like a treat, you know.
Yeah. I just put it on the back. Like I had a whole bunch of like Lorcana cards that I was opening. I put it on in the background, just like occasionally. Like, oh, I love this scene. I love that shot.
Oh, so are you into that? The Lorcana. That's the Disney card game.
I am. Yeah. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Yeah, I watched Empire Strikes Back, and I'm happy I did that before watching Dune 2, because there's clear evidence within the Dune movie that these two movies are very similar, because you're starting with a bunch of rebels, you know, who are hiding away.
Right.
You're on a planet full of like, you know, either snow in one case or sand in the other, and it's just a very harsh, arid landscape. But you also have like the Empire that's trying to bring them down. You have like the Harkonnens who are like constantly bombarding these people, or the Galactic Empire who are bombarding the rebels. So there's just a bunch of parallels, and like there's even like I don't want to get too much into it just because it does get a little spoilery. But there is significant proof that George Lucas took heavy inspiration from the Dune book, and it's really cool how it all kind of plays out. So might be a fun experiment if you haven't seen the Dune movie yet, the new one that's in theaters right now, to watch Empire Strikes Back before seeing it. You'll find a lot of really, really fun parallels, even to the extent of like them bringing down like the AT-ATs in Empire Strikes Back, you know, like that scene right. where they're going around the AT-ATs and like finding unique ways to bring them down. You get that level of action in the Dune movie. It's cool. Yeah. Dune good.
Awesome, man. Yeah, and just been... Well, I think I told you last time that I had been playing this game called Helldivers 2.
You mentioned it, yeah.
Which is like it's a mix of Halo and...
I'm not sure that you mentioned it on the podcast. We actually... Oh. So I visited Florida and Anthony got to hang out with me and my family for an evening. And I think that's where you mentioned it to me. But yeah, you've been playing Helldivers. You were saying that it's like Halo and what?
Right. So there's a good bit of it that's like Halo. It's a lot. It's got a huge, huge inspiration from Starship Troopers because you're coming down onto these planets and you're fighting bugs. But then you're also fighting like these, they call them automatons in some of the other worlds. So it's really fun. It's a game it's a live service game, so it's always online. So you're a lot of the times you're fighting for control of these planets. So the bugs, where they call them terminids, they're trying to, you know, take over a planet. And so all the players, or a lot of players, will go to this one planet to really like fight to like liberate this planet from, you know, the bugs attacking. And so it's pretty cool to see, because they have there's like the stats and everything. They'll show like how many people are fighting here, how many shots are being shot, how much ordnance is being used, and it'll show the percentage of it being liberated and stuff. And then at the end of a mission, it'll show how much your squad contributed to that liberation and stuff. It's really cool seeing that. It's a really fun game, and like the harder you make the difficulties, it just gets so insane. It's
That's awesome. Cool, man. Yeah,
it's a great time.
My brother's playing it. He's having a good time with it, and I've you know, a bunch of people are playing it. It's a huge game right now. I think it's bigger than the developers thought it was going
to
be.
Oh, absolutely. Like the developers wanted it to be successful, obviously, but I mean, dude, like they had server issues for like a few days, like maybe like 3 to 5 days. They were having server issues where like you would have to kind of sit in a queue. And it'll say, you know, servers are full, and then it'll like kind of retry like every 20 seconds.
Oh, wow.
And so you would essentially just have to sit there until, you know, you got put into the game. But they eventually worked on the server issues. They got those done. They've got that figured out. And so there's some other bugs that they're trying to figure out. But the game is definitely starting to feel a lot more fine-tuned, and you know, I was still having a fun time with it. I had watched a few of my friends play it before I got it. I was like, yo, this game looks really fun. And yeah, man, it's a good time. And it's not like a full price game. I think it's like $30, $40 that I had bought.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. Cool.
So yeah, man. So how about you? What have you been up to?
I mean,
we talked about Dune. We talked about you watching Empire, which I did also.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Like I mentioned, I visited Florida. It's my home state. I was born and raised there. I lived there till I was 13. But I go pretty regularly. Maybe like two, maybe three times a year. Usually around two times a year. Just to visit family. Sometimes I go to Disney World when I'm down there. And I did get the opportunity to visit the parks for a couple days. I did Magic Kingdom and Animal Kingdom. Always a good time. But while I was down there, speaking about Disney's Lorcana trading card game, which I've been into for a while now, for a couple months. So I've been like, you know, just collecting the trading cards. I'm not so much into actually like playing the trading card game. You know, I'm more I'm a collector at heart, you know, like I like the look of like seeing like a binder full of like a full set or whatever. I don't have any full sets yet, but they were releasing the third set of Lorcana cards on like on the trip that I was out in Disney World. So at Disney Springs, they had this huge like line, like an opening release thing. And I thought that for sure, like I was not going to be able to get anything, because when I got there, I was like 30 minutes early, but there were so many people in line waiting to grab cards that I didn't think that I was going to be able to snag any of the new merchandise. And lo and behold, dude, they were stacked. Like the walls were lined in the, you know, the big World of Disney store in Disney Springs.
Yes.
Like where the cash registers were, like all the walls were lined with like boxes and boxes of those cards, dude. It was, they had so much stock. I was so impressed because like Lorcana up to this point has been kind of plagued. Well, not so much anymore, but like the first 2-3 months of Lorcana being a thing, you couldn't find cards anywhere. Like Disney Springs was completely sold out of them. The parks were sold out of them. Hobby stores were sold out of them. Target, you could never find anything. Anywhere where you could buy like trading cards, it was just out of stock. Recently, the company that's been printing them, Ravensburger, has been like, you know, really upping their the output basically, because they didn't expect it to be such a huge hit right off the bat, but it turned out it was like absolutely massive. So basically what it is, if you guys don't know, it's Disney trading cards. So you have hundreds, maybe thousands of Disney characters out there. So every set of cards, there's three now, has about 204 cards in their mix. And they take a number of, like they take a handful, maybe like 10 movies, and they'll make fresh new looks for characters from those movies. Or they'll use like songs as sort of like action cards. Or like, you know, you have item cards based on like what the characters have. So, you know, like there's like the magic brooms from like the Fantasia movie. You have obviously characters like Mickey and Minnie and like tons and tons of different variations of outfits. But like what's cool about them is that the art is so creative, and it's most of the time really beautiful. So I've been collecting that for a little bit. You know, now I'm not breaking the bank or anything. It's just, you know, passively, oh, I'll buy a couple packs today while I'm here. Oh, I'll crack a couple cards open. So that's been fun. I actually brought my cards with me to Disney World, and I had some of the characters sign cards for me. You know how like you know how like they always have like the autograph books at Disney World, and you can have kids sign like, or have the characters sign their autograph in the autograph books.
Yeah.
I brought my cards. And the people in the costumes were so excited to sign the Lorcana cards, and so that was fun. And yeah, while I was there, I was there for like the third set pre-release, so that was really fun. So that for me has been like the highlight of my last couple of weeks.
Oh, that's cool. Did you line it up to do that, or
no,
was that just
I found
like a
out,
happy coincidence?
I found out like the week before that the third set was releasing in the parks early, when I was going to be in the parks. So we were in the parks Wednesday and Thursday, and we were leaving Friday, and they were releasing the Disney Lorcana third set on that Friday at Disney Springs. So I was just like, oh my gosh, that's perfect. So I'll just, you know, wake up early in the morning on Friday, leave the resort that we were staying at, and you know, I'll wait in line, grab a couple cards, and it totally worked out.
Oh, that's sick. Yeah. That's cool.
It lined up perfectly.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so that's been pretty fun. I'm just really, what's fun about that is it kind of brings me back to like my days as a kid, you know, playing Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh. The feeling of cracking open a pack of cards and seeing what you get. There's really nothing like it, you know? I love it. Yeah, it's cool.
We were, you know, built to enjoy these. Or we grew up to enjoy these, like, you know, that's probably why you like the gacha games, because
I know
it has that same effect. Yeah, no, I agree. There's a lot of card games that I only collected that I didn't really play. Pokemon obviously was one of them. I didn't play the game. I only really cared about, I would say the first two generations were the ones that I really like pressed the most to collect, and the Yu-Gi-Oh cards, you know, like the first like maybe couple of releases for those.
Yu-Gi-Oh was huge when we were kids, man. So was Pokemon, yeah. You know, but it was Pokemon first, and then Yu-Gi-Oh came, and like all the kids who collected Pokemon were suddenly really into Yu-Gi-Oh, and it's just kind of funny how that happened. But
Yu-Gi-Oh really set themselves up for that because it was a card game within the show. So you're like, oh yeah, I want to get these. You know, I want to get that Dark Magician. You know, I want to get that Blue Eyes White Dragon.
There's
only
three Blue Eyes White Dragon in the world.
Yeah, right. You know, when really there's like, you know, thousands. But yeah, that I totally get what you're talking about. I did play Magic, though. But you knew that. Like, that was probably one of the few card games that I actually, like, sat down and played.
Magic is the one that is probably... I would say Yu-Gi-Oh! 2 is a really fun game. But Magic is probably the most enduring of the actual trading card games that are actually still played regularly. And still releases cards regularly. You know, as far as, like, market cap and, like, how much cards are sold, Pokemon is still by far, like... 90% of the entire market of how much, you know, trading cards sell. But when it comes to like Magic the Gathering, I respect it so much more because they're the OG trading card game, and like their art is just unparalleled.
They're the D&D of the trading card world.
I mean, they're both created by, I mean, I know D&D wasn't created by Wizards of the Coast, but they're both currently owned by Wizards of the Coast.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah.
They do a lot of crossovers, too. They did the Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah. Dude, I have a whole bunch of Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering cards. So, funny enough, I started with Lorcana, like, you know, about like last summer. I started trying to get into Lorcana, but because there was never any Lorcana in stock, and I was just like, I kind of want to get this fix out of my system, just like to crack something open. So I started getting some of the Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering cards. They had a Doctor Who Magic the Gathering set, and I've gotten a couple others. Not a lot of cards, but you know, just enough to like, oh, this is fun. I'll see what I can get. Same with Pokemon. I grabbed a couple packs of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But like the one that you were really like set on, like, actually collecting was Lorcana.
Yeah, Lorcana, but for the longest time it was just unavailable anywhere. Or like if you wanted to buy like a pack of cards, like a normal booster, it was like upcharge like $10 to $15 no matter where you were. It was just like
you're spending crazy
double or triple what the pack is worth. But anyway, it's supply and demand, am I right?
Alrighty.
Wanna jump into Empire?
Yeah, I was gonna say we're almost 30 minutes into the podcast. Yeah, let's talk about Empire.
I wonder how many people like get super pissed off about it, like us just like rambling about random stuff in the first like half of our episodes. But it's part of the fun. So I mean, if you're either here with us or you're against us.
Look, y'all, we've known each other for over 20 years, so there's gonna be a lot to talk about.
Yeah, so this is. It's kind of funny when I think about it, just because most podcasts don't do like our little preamble where we just like catch up on each other's lives, but we're best friends. Like we've been hanging out for literally since like what, third grade, and
I think earlier than that,
maybe. Yeah, it's been a long time. So every time we go to record, it's also a time for us to catch up. So that's kind of part of the charm of what we got going on here. But all right. Without further ado, Empire Strikes Back. Anthony, have you ever seen this movie?
I saw it for the first 100th time.
Your first 100th time. You know what's...
Absolutely, man. I've seen Empire Strikes Back so many times. It's often heralded as the best out of all of Star Wars movies.
It's actually the first Star Wars movie I ever saw. So my dad... I must have been 5 or 6, and they re-released the videos on VHS in the 90s, the movie, I mean. And I remember being at Toys R Us, and my dad saw, you know, a copy of Empire Strikes Back on VHS, like on a shelf. And I know that he knew that A New Hope was, you know, the first one, but he was really excited to rewatch Empire. So he bought Empire, and that was the first Star Wars movie that I was introduced to, and I absolutely loved it. So I remember, like, as a kid, my mom would always, like, put, starting with Empire Strikes Back, we would eventually get the other VHSs in the set, and I would just constantly every day watch at least one Star Wars movie. And my mom, I used to ask my mom like the dumbest questions, like, who is that guy? Who is this person? Why did they do that? You know, like stupid kid stuff. And it got to the point where like my mom had no answers, just like, that's just a weird spider thing in Jabba's palace. I don't know. Stuff like that.
The classic parent answer.
Yeah. But that was really fun. Just growing up like that. And it's really hard to talk about a film like this that both of us are so familiar with and like give an honest review, because it's something that's always been in our lives, I think.
Right. Well, but the thing is that like the consensus for this is that it's a really good Star Wars movie, you know? Like it's the best Star Wars movie, you know, even outside of what you and I say. It's you have such a like a deep memory of when you watch Star Wars, but like me, like I knew that my dad showed me these Star Wars movies at a young age, and I just remember seeing them. I don't remember, you know, like periods of time like that where like I would sit down and ask questions about this and that. I just remember seeing them, and I just don't have like a deep memory like that. But I will say that this movie does have a lot of my favorites, and it has like one of my favorite battles, which is the Battle of Hoth, dude. I absolutely love the Battle of Hoth. You get those giant AT-ATs, you get the AT-STs in there. For as long as I remember, a lot of like Star Wars games and the ones in the arcade always had like this Battle of Hoth. You would have to go in the snow speeder and try to take down the AT-ATs with the tow cable and harpoon, and it's always been one of my absolute favorites. And like Battlefront games, yeah. That was always in rotation for me. So I always liked to play the Rebels, but every once in a while I would hop on the Empire, because you can actually like use the AT-ATs, and those are like just super unfair to absolutely unfair to use. Yeah, man. It has one of my favorite, like that part has one of my favorite tracks, which is like that the Battle of Hoth medley.
Mm. Okay.
And it's really cool because I also looked at the history of, or like I looked at like where they shot for this like battle. Dude, they were like out there in the middle of nowhere in freezing cold temperatures, bro. And like, what was it, like Finland or Norway?
I don't know. Yeah, I actually have no idea, but it probably was
it was they were like deep out, and like it was like a glacier.
It could have been Iceland.
Yeah,
then. Let's so, look this up. Where was the Battle of Hoth filmed? Okay, so they were at the Hardangerjokull Glacier and Finse, Norway.
Norway, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so
because I remember watching a YouTube, it was like a YouTube video of this group that they actually made that like trek out there. And yeah, man, it's just, I remember reading that like the cast and crew had to really deal with like sub-zero temperatures,
heavy cold. Yeah. Like it wasn't a joke. Yeah, it's so
yeah,
cool.
they were freezing in real life. Like you saw how it seemed like they were freezing in the film. Yeah, that was like real life, you know. But
love it.
It's so cool that they set up a space, and then And then like the miniatures, like you can tell like the moments that they're using like the miniatures.
Yeah.
But I absolutely like, I love it, man. Like just the use of the technology that they had back then. It just looked great, man. I loved it. I love every moment of this film.
Honestly, part of the stop motion miniatures, you know, within this movie is, you know, part of its charm, because you have the use of like actual live action people running, or you know, like planes flying around these miniatures, or not planes, but you know, like the speeders,
right? Right.
And you have these big machines that are moving super mechanically, or you know, the tauntauns that aren't perfect, but that's part of the charm of this. And it doesn't look bad. It doesn't look bad. It just it looks like it's like meant to be that way, just because the movie has always been that way, you know. So that's something that I've always really, really appreciated.
And they have those like practical tauntaun effects too, so it's cool. Like you have, you know, the miniatures, and then
that's
you
true.
Actually have like the life size tauntauns. Yeah, and they really like went like just so deep into this to make the. I would say, like, when I think, when somebody talks about movie magic, like, this is, like, a perfect example of movie magic, where you're not using, you know, 90% CGI, you know, you're using, you know, practical effects, and then some of the CGI, well, their version of CGI really just complemented it, you know, like the blaster fire and all that stuff.
Yeah, and they really were at the height of, you know, Hollywood innovation at this time. You know, in the first movie they were at the height of Hollywood innovation, but like they really stepped it up to another degree with this sequel. They had Phil Tippett, who was doing the stop motion, and he kind of pioneered that just incredible look and feel of not only, how do I describe it? It wasn't like just shot for shot, and you could see like the, you know, each frame, but there's a little bit of motion blur in all of these frames that he pioneered, that they incorporated in these movies, that just brought it to life. Yeah, so the Battle of Hoth, it's gorgeous to look at. It's also just strikingly different from everything that we saw in the first movie. So the first movie, we saw a lot of Tatooine. We saw a lot of the Death Star and, you know, small locations like Yavin. We got the pyramid in Yavin, and then
the Mayans.
Yeah, know? Like it's like a Mayan Aztec pyramid in the middle of a forest. It's cool. It's a cool concept.
Yeah.
It kind of evokes the fact that there's like this ancient civilization that no longer exists, and they're just like using this as a base. But yeah, you have a couple of those places that kind of give you a feel of what Star Wars is, and then this movie changes that entirely. You have the Battle of Hoth, or like, you know, the Hoth planet in general is just like a big ball of ice and snow, and that's strikingly different from like the desert in the first movie. Then you have Dagobah, which is purely a swamp planet, and it's just the coolest set you've ever seen. Lots of like fog and snakes and like lizards and stuff, and a little green guy, little freaky green guy. and then you have the asteroid that has a space slug in it, and it's just like, what the heck? They really went all out in like just giving you new venues, new vistas to really just soak in and understand that this universe is, this galaxy is so much bigger than what you saw in the first movie.
No, yeah, I agree. And I mean, like, can we really appreciate like how awesome they made like space look in these old films? And like,
yeah,
the shot of like the entire planets, like for back then, like it's so believable,
yeah,
that they're in space. It's so believable that they're looking at some other planet. You look back at a lot of these like older films and you think about what they had available to them, and like they maximized what was available to them, you know? Like I was just, it blows my mind. You know, we talked about that this exact thing when we cover Godzilla. Like, you know, they might have not had all the technology in the world, but they used what they had, and
they made it work.
They were at the height of whatever it was back then, you know?
Yeah, they made it work, and they made it believable. You know, if we can still believe it today, how much more so would people who've never seen anything like that in 1980 have felt like going to the theater? You know?
Oh, that's how, yeah, absolutely.
That, you know, talking about New Vistas, the city in the sky, Cloud City, like, dude, there's so many locations in this movie. The asteroid field, like on board Vader's Star Destroyer. It's such a cool movie. Like, it just oozes cool. And like you said, the individual shots of space and like the vehicles flying through it, or the asteroids,
the shot of the planets.
Yeah, or the overhead shots of the planets as it like pans down. All of this looked so believable, and I'm sure, like, you know, audiences in the 80s or, you know, 1980 were just floored by what they were able to accomplish. And outside of all of that, you know, it is sci-fi, it is science fantasy, but outside of it, it's a very human story. I think that's what the real heart of Star Wars is, you know, outside of, like, how cool it is, outside of the lightsaber battles, is that, like, these characters are believable. They have human issues. They want to be noticed by the princess. They want to, you know, train to be the best that they can be, but they also want to save their friends, and they make mistakes along the way. They don't finish their training, blah, blah, blah. It's all believable stuff, even though it's, like, on a fantastical scale. And I think that's the real charm of Star Wars. And I was thinking about it this time around while, you know, I was rewatching the movie, is that there's not a whole lot that's happening if you really boil it down, you know? These rebels are on the run. Luke goes to get training. The rebels that are on the run get, you know, in trouble with the Empire. Luke has to stop his training. And then there's the final battle.
Right.
That's five sentences.
Yep. It's the the Empire Strikes Back, you know?
Yeah. You can boil it down into five sentences. And the fact is, they made an entire movie out of that. They made a whole script about, like, what that story would look like. And
you're on the run after a pretty massive victory.
Yeah, yeah. And, dude, they made it perfect. I love it.
What would you say?
Yeah.
What made this film click so much more so than the first film? The first film, obviously, we'll always love it because it's original. It established this world. It did a lot of the world building. But it goes without saying that Empire Strikes Back is a lot better than the first film. At least for me, it is. What made it work? Because remember, we talked about this when we covered A New Hope. George Lucas was not betting on this film. He was betting on somebody else's film to be successful, not his own film.
Yeah. When it comes to Empire, I don't know that I would say it's significantly better than the first movie. I will say that I like it more. I will say that I do think it's the better film. But I don't think it's necessarily like something that clicked more for audiences. I think people that liked the first one were gonna like the second one. You know, there are actually like reviews out there from like early days of Empire where like there were negative reviews about Empire Strikes Back, like a poor sequel, blah blah blah. But obviously those opinions have just faded into the ether at this point, just because the vast majority of people absolutely are stunned by it. So what I think,
every beloved movie is gonna have
naysayers. Yeah,
there, I mean, there's, I would say, like, we very hardly will ever see like a perfectly scored movie.
Yeah,
even like, dude, like, I mean, we talked about Dune 2. There's people who have gripes about this, but you absolutely loved it, right?
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I have my gripes about Dune 2, mostly in the fact that it changes some things that I really liked about the book. But I understand that it's 100%. The vision of the director, and he nailed it. Whatever he changed, he nailed. But anyway,
it's the same fact for Empire Strikes Back. You know, whatever it is that whatever like movie vision that they had for this sequel just nailed it, you know, like they like followed whatever path that they had in their mind and it worked.
So I think a big factor outside of just continuing the story and like following the characters that you've grown to love and seeing their interpersonal relationships grow is the new additions to the lore surrounding the Jedi and the mysticism that the power that Jedi's wield can hold. Like, we didn't know after watching the first movie that you were able to lift a whole ship with your mind, you know, until Yoda was able to do it.
Right. Yoda is a cool Jedi, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, you know what? Let's talk about that, actually. So I had a email address. Like, my first email address was Yoda is a Jedi. And it was like a, I forget even what it was called. Like, it was a Hotmail address. And then you had one where it was like, Yoda is a cool Jedi. And I was like pissed a little bit because you had the you had the better email address.
Oh my gosh.
But anyway,
dude, kids with their dumb emails.
God. It's a little cringe, but it's like the kind of cringe you just gotta like just let out in the open. Anyway, yeah. So I think part of it is just like the new additions to the lore and like understanding the world a little bit better, what Jedis are capable of. And, you know, the fact that this 900-year-old green guy was teaching Jedi for 800 years and he's like the most unlikely person to, you know, actually be like a trained Jedi master is such a cool concept because it kind of treats the audience like they already have that prejudice, you know, like, oh, this guy's annoying, like let's get rid of him because like I want to see Master Yoda, I want to see Luke get trained by the guy with the wise beard, you know, like who's sitting on a rock somewhere out there. You kind of expect that when you hear about, like, you know, a mystical master of some sort, but then you have this little guy with the cane who's crazy and throwing Luke snacks everywhere.
I know, yeah, seriously, when you get the introduction to Yoda, he really does act like this, like, senile, old, like, alien creature thing. That's just, like, and then, like, him just, like, having that, like, tug of war for the snack between him and R2, and he's just, like, hitting him with the cane.
Mine! Yeah.
It's so funny. And then like, as years go, you know, they go by, we have a bit more of a fuller picture of who Yoda is and how he is this revered Jedi master through, you know, through the prequels, through the books, through the comics.
Yeah, totally.
Now we understand, like, you know, why this Yoda guy is
who he is.
Who he is.
Yeah, and
but
like,
still, you know, like, let's say, was it 1980? What is that? 40? How many?
44.
44 years, and we still don't know his species.
Yeah, we don't know the name of his species, which is pretty crazy.
Him and Yaddle, even though they tried to bury her, we still remember Yaddle.
Yeah. Did you ever see Tales of the Jedi? It was like that 6-part.
I did
part.
Not.
They have an episode. It's short. It's a Dooku-based episode about, like, how he changed, like, how he became Darth Sidious, and, like, his final act was having to basically kill Yaddle. And it was so good. Dude, it's, like, 15 minutes. You should definitely give it a watch. It's so, so fantastic. Yeah, so I like the scene when they're in the hut, like, Yoda's hut, and he's trying to get Luke to just, you know, eat some of the food that he has prepared, and Luke's like, what am I doing here? I have better things to do. And Yoda's like, he finally like cracks and he's just like, I cannot train him. And you hear Obi-Wan's voice again, and it takes Luke a second. It takes Luke like 5 seconds to realize, wait, that's Yoda? And it just kind of shows his his built-in prejudice, and probably the audience's built-in prejudice, because up to that point we probably didn't realize that this was the master that, you know, we were supposed to be, you know, seeing, and he's basically just being like the drunken master at this point, you know.
Right. We're thinking, you know, possibly that this person might lead Luke to the actual Yoda.
Yeah.
And no, that's Yoda. But you know what? I actually love that they went with a small green guy as one of the best Jedi masters ever. I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Because it really does go to show, look, man.
Sizes, you know, and everything.
Right. That he doesn't have to be this big, brawlic individual to be able to do some of this amazing things. And I love that moment where Luke tries to lift his X-Wing out of the swamp, but he can't do it. But Yoda does it. And he says, I can't, you know, he's like, I can't believe it. And Yoda's like, that is why you fail.
Yeah. Yeah. So good.
And
it just,
yeah,
like, it hints at all, like, the more major, like, Jedi tenets that you learn about later in the prequels, you know?
Right.
And it's just I think what's great about it is that, like, it gives you just enough information about who the Jedi are, what they believe, like, that you need patience, you need to be kind, you need to not have these built-in prejudices. And it actually even, like, goes into, like, how, like, the Jedi would teach younglings, because he said that he's too old at this point. He's, like, what, 21 at this age in this movie? And you think of a 21-year-old, you know, you and I are 32. You think of a 21-year-old as someone who is very young, yes, someone who's very susceptible to learning a new skill, a new trade. But the Jedi, they train kids, you know, into adulthood.
Right. Well, and it kind of makes me think, you know, in a way that it does make sense, because a lot of people who learn some, you know, like even martial arts, you know, I mean, technically you're never too old to, like, learn, but the best ages to learn is at a younger age. You know, you don't really have a lot of these distractions. You haven't really lived life that much. So you're pretty much an open vessel to learn. So Luke has lived life at this point. He literally just blew up a Death Star. He's experienced war a bit. So it's definitely a lot tougher. He's got a lot more on his mind. And so I really like that there's that cave that he goes through.
Oh yeah. And it's so important.
And so it kind of drops a hint of who Darth Vader is before he finds out who Darth Vader is.
Yeah, and speaking about that, you have that foreshadowing of, you know, when he cuts off Vader's head and sees his own face reflected there. That was probably really confusing for people. But I also like, you know, when he realizes that his friends are in trouble over in Cloud City, that he makes a run for it, and Yoda's like, don't do it. And then Obi-Wan, you know, as he leaves, you hear Obi-Wan's voice. He is our last hope. And then, like, it fades on black, and Yoda goes, no, there is another. And it's just like, wait, what? There's another?
And it's just, yeah, like, yeah.
And what's really cool about that is it teases the audience that, like, Luke might die. Luke might not make it out of this, because Yoda said that there's another hope outside of Luke. So you're suddenly like, oh, Luke is actually expendable in like the grand scheme of things. Obviously nobody wants to dispense of Luke, but yeah, that's kind of the vibe that gives. And
they were talking about Ahsoka at that point.
Yeah, or Ezra.
Ezra.
Yoda's like,
or a Cal Kestis.
Ezra's not too far away, guys.
Oh my gosh.
No, but yeah, we're talking about Leia. But anyway,
this is the movie that we get Boba Fett also.
Dude, we get Boba Fett, we get Lando. Boba Fett is huge. The fact that, you know, so much has been built around, like, the show Mandalorian wouldn't exist if Boba Fett wasn't a thing.
Right.
It's crazy how, like, little stuff like that changes the course of, like, how franchises work. Just like, you get a cool character with a rocket launcher. And it just changes the whole fandom.
And Knights of the Old Republic kind of perpetuates that also.
Oh yeah.
That they have Mandalorians, and then there's this whole
Mandalorian also War. Like
a, yeah, like a Mandalorian Wars back then. Yeah, dude, there's a lot. But yeah, we get that. This is Han Solo and Han Solo gets captured, and for Boba Fett takes him. You know, he gets his bounty from.
Oh, and from, it's probably the best line in the entire movie is when, you know, he's going into the carbonite freezing chamber and Leia goes, "I love you." And he goes, "I know." It's so cocky. It's so perfect.
It's so Han.
It's so Han. Yeah. And it's just clever. It's just really just clever writing. Like they make these people so human. But, you know, this all leads up to the final battle with Luke and Vader. And we find out, you know, Luke mentions that you killed my father. And then Vader says the iconic line, "No, I am your father." Like, basically, Obi-Wan lied to you. I'm actually your father. And up to this point, like, Vader's been having conversations with the Emperor. They've been talking about, like, the son of Skywalker. And we had no idea that Vader is the son of... is actually the Skywalker in question, because he's so divorced from that role. He's not that person anymore.
And you get that in the Obi-Wan series, where he's just like, you didn't kill Anakin, I killed Anakin. Yeah, this is actually one of those movies where there's a Mandela thing that happens.
Yeah,
Mandela where effect. Everybody thinks that it's Luke, I am your father, but it's no, I am your father.
Yeah, I mean it's a pretty simple one, but like most people remember it as Luke, I am your father, which is funny. But
they even put it into like TV shows and stuff. Like it's.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
What's great about this one, besides the fact that the whole movie is great, is that it ends on such a crazy cliffhanger. We find out Luke is Vader's son.
Yes.
Han gets frozen in carbonite and taken by a bounty hunter to Jabba the Hutt, who up to this point we don't know because he wasn't in the first movie originally. We have the rebels basically on the run again, and Luke... has lost his hand after his fight with Vader, and basically all hope seems lost. You know, by the end it's just like a crushing thing. Like you feel for Luke because like the worst guy in the galaxy is your dad and everything's just been brought down on you, and Luke didn't finish his training,
right?
So it's just the worst possible case scenario, but like the best possible cliffhanger for fans to keep, you know, theorizing and waiting for the final movie in that trilogy.
You also get a glimpse of who Leia truly is, because she kind of has like a force moment where she connects with Luke, because Luke calls out to her. Remember when he's like, he falls after that battle with Vader.
That's
kind of hanging at the bottom of one of the, like, you know, the platforms.
Like an antenna on the bottom, yeah.
Yeah. And so he calls out to Leia. And Leia, like, feels it and was able to, like, guide to where Luke was. And so that's, like, her first, like, force moment, you know, or that we know of.
Yeah. It's an incredible scene. And it foreshadows the fact that she's also Skywalker. She's also a hope that, you know, Yoda has in store, you know, if Luke doesn't fall through. Yeah, so like all those cliffhangers combined leads to some of the, like, one of the most perfect endings to a movie. And then they have that beautiful shot of, like, it almost looks like a galaxy, even though, like, technically they're in the galaxy, so it's kind of a confusing it's almost like a Milky Way nebula type thing. But anyway, guys, thank you for listening to us here for our 72nd episode of Project Geekology. We hope you like Star Wars because we love it. Yeah, we can't wait to talk about Return of the King. We can't wait to talk about Return of the Jedi, but next time you catch us, we're probably going to be covering something a little bit different from our usual fare. We're going to cover Saving Private Ryan. You might have heard of it.
Yes. That really good World War II movie.
But you can check out our socials in the show notes down below. And we look forward to having you with us next time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.